Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Phil Beverly, Patrick Cotter, Marty Garrity, and Michael Lotus. Our program tonight comes to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you want to email me a comment, it's BruceDumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. That is the audio and video portion of this program every week. And if you miss it, it's always there. So you can never, you really never have to miss the show. We have so much to pack into our 2 hours this evening. Later on in the broadcast, we're going to be talking about the tragedy in Parkland, Florida. And we are going to begin, however, with a story that really has really thrust on the scene mid-Friday with the announcement by the Justice Department that there was an indictment of 13 Russians for their involvement in the lead-up to the 2016 presidential campaign, a campaign that began back in 2014 to disrupt the democratic process. We're going to talk an awful lot about that this evening with expert guests, but I want to begin with the statements of the Assistant Attorney General in making the announcement on Friday.
Defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare against the United States, with the stated goal of spreading distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general. There is no allegation in this indictment that any American was a knowing participant in this illegal activity. There is no allegation in the indictment that the charged conduct altered the outcome of the 2016 election.
Before I get to the specifics of the indictment, I want to get everybody's reaction to a comment that was made on Fox News Sunday by Charles Lane of the Washington Post. Because these 13 people, and they all live in Russia, none of them are going to be behind bars, not likely. There's going to be no extradition in this case. That really what this indictment is a wake-up call to the American people that the Russians did what they did in one election, or is alleged what they did in one election, and they're going to keep doing it again and again, and it's going to grow. So, Patrick Cotter, you're a former assistant U.S. attorney from Brooklyn, New York. Do you see this as a wake-up call, or is it a lot more than that?
Well, I don't think it was intended as a wake-up call. It may serve that purpose. I think it was intended to do what Mr. Mueller and his team were charged to do, which was to determine whether there was any evidence that Russians had involved themselves in our election. And I think it does that, and I think it does so very forcefully.
Michael Lotus, our Trump Republican, what do you think?
The Russians have involved themselves in any of the internal politics of their enemies and their neighbors for centuries, and the Soviet Union was very, very good at it. And it's not particularly surprising that they're doing this now.
Philip Beverly, our other Democrat, did this surprise you, Philip? Anything in here surprise you?
No. I think it's just the continuation of Mueller's investigation and firing a shot across the bow for Putin to say, yeah, we see you, and we're watching, and we identified, and we can see more of your operation than you believe.
Marty Garrity is our card-carrying Republican. Are you alarmed at this indictment? Any surprise to you in it?
No, I'm not alarmed because, as Philip says, this is something that you just assume that the Russians and other countries have done. Frankly, what alarms me is Trump. And I didn't vote for Trump, but I was delighted that he beat Hillary. But what alarms me is that he's refusing to say, oh, yeah, you know what, it wasn't proved before now, but boy, it sure looks like they did do this. And we should, you know, I would encourage the law enforcement people to stay after them. And I think that a result of this is not that necessarily it'll be easier for the Russians to do this. It'll be more difficult now that they know that the FBI is looking at them with a very jaundiced eye and saying, we're going to catch you at this if you try this again.
Are you confident that the FBI is going to catch them if they continue to do this?
Well, let's remember, the FBI has two components. One is a law investigation of cases for legal prosecutions, and one is a counterintelligence function, which is unique, I think, to the United States. Most countries, those are separate functions. Presumably, they're doing this sort of thing all the time. The question is whether it makes sense to attempt to thwart these types of activities in our country through the legal process of people you can't extradite, can't really prosecute, and will never imprison, rather than through the espionage and counterintelligence process.
But Patrick?
I want to point something out. It is a long document, and I don't encourage anybody to read it for pleasure, but I have read it. And one of the things that leaps out of it to me is that the detail that they know about this operation, the detail. They know the exact names that they stole. They know the bank accounts. They know the PayPal accounts. Right. They know the dates they did it. And I think this is the kind of – this is what a prosecutor calls a talking indictment, which is to say there's a lot of unnecessary detail in here. And I think it's because we may not be able to catch these people and actually prosecute them. This is a message to the Russians that we've got somebody inside. We've got somebody inside. We know exactly what you're doing. So if you think you're going to do the same things, you're not going to be able to because we
question,
know.
Honest question, though.
Philip, I'm
sorry.
We
did that with the Chinese hackers when we tracked down the building that the PLA cyber warriors operated from in Beijing, just to let them know we can find you. We can reach out and touch you if we want. And I think that this is the same thing. We're going to let you know we see you.
There's a building in Moscow that's named in this indictment.
Right, the 55 address.
Was it prudent to disclose that we have the capability to know that much detail if we're never going to put these people in prison?
No, I think that's exactly why. That's exactly why. Because you want to tell them that you think you're doing all these things and we don't know what you're doing, but we are inside your organization. And I guarantee you, this is what this tells me. If this was the mafia, if this was all about the Gambino family, everybody in the mafia would read it, or they'd ask their lawyers to read it, and then they would say, oh, my God, we got a rat.
And who
Russians,
is it? And they
the
start
Russians
looking
right
at each
now
other.
Are running around trying to figure out who's the rat.
Why did we disclose that we have a rat?
Because sometimes that's what you want to do. You want to disrupt them. You want to cause them to not keep doing the same things. You want to put as the phrase was used by somebody, it's a shot across the bow. Mm.
One thing that was important, and this is something that the Trump campaign or President Trump has said, is that this started in 2014, long before Donald Trump was planning to run for president of the United States, or at least publicly running for president of the United States, and that this was a build-up to a 2016 campaign, and they were looking, they were interested in providing derogatory information about Ted Cruz, about Marco Rubio, and about Hillary Clinton. So it started in that thing as they were looking for the people who were the obvious choices to maybe challenge each other in 2016, and they were taking a buildup of 2 years to begin to sow these seeds of discontent in the electoral process, and that's sort of what we're talking about this evening. It's what the indictment is about, and when we come back, we want to talk about how they did it, and most importantly, is there any realistic way we as a nation can combat it? 1-800-723-8029, talking about the indictment of 13 Russians for their involvement in the 2016 presidential campaign, and before that, and after that.
It's 1985 brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Continuing, I'm Bruce Dumont in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. At the core of this indictment is that the Russians were out there trying to fan discontent. There was discord in the country. They wanted to fan it. Now, we knew, and we talked about for a year and a half on this program, there was discord. You had the Bernie Sanders people. You had the Donald Trump people. Both of them were anti-establishment. They were both running campaigns. They were saying things that were not complimentary about the United States government. That's what a political campaign is about. So the Russians were not necessarily making anything up. They were just they were being a megaphone, if you will, in spreading the frustration that the American people already had.
No, I disagree completely.
I disagree.
Okay, tell me.
Totally. Yeah.
What did they do? Phil, what did they do?
When
above
you create,
and beyond that,
when you
they
create
do?
Fake identities and you generate fake news stories,
yes.
That's not fanning discontent in an authentic way. Yeah, I agree. There's discontent. I've said on this show before that both political parties have made a huge mistake in not listening to elements of their bases that are angry. They just haven't been listening. And so now you get a Trump, and on the other side, the centrist Clintons get defeated finally. So here's the issue. If you were just reflecting back that thing, that's fine. But that's not what was happening.
But if you were at a political rally, and thousands of people came to that rally to support Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, either one, and in that group you infiltrated some Russians that were carrying, you know, waving flags or carrying placards. I mean, that's sort of what we're talking about here, but we're talking about doing it in a very sophisticated way.
No, there's a lot more to it.
Tell me more about
it. If you read the indictment, it talks about the fact that they actually created false organizations.
Yes.
And at least one of the false organizations' purpose was to try to convince minorities, Muslims and blacks, not to vote. Not to vote. Mm-hmm. That's not just, you know, repeating, echoing sentiments that are out there. They're telling them not to vote. They created organizations. It's one thing if there's one organization out there saying, you know, don't vote if you're black. But when you start creating new organizations, when you start buying thousands of advertisements, and that's in the indictment,
yes,
in which you're telling Muslims not to vote, you're telling blacks not to vote, that's not...
Or infiltrating the Black Lives Matter.
Or infiltrating...
Fanning that legitimate issue.
Right, and also attributing false statements to candidates. That's not echoing. That's creating false news. You know, I understand your
so
point.
So there is fake news.
There is.
Oh,
but
it's, yeah.
But
well,
my point
okay,
is...
Well, that's an important point.
Yes.
Because the first person that used that term was Donald Trump during the campaign. And what this indictment says was... There really was fake news on both sides.
Bruce, no, I think you're calling apples and oranges the same thing.
Correct me.
I was just about to say, if Russia wants to send over reporters to go to the rally and say, hey, look at all these people who are upset with Hillary Clinton, or look at all these people who are upset with Donald Trump, mm-hmm. or that's fine. That's echoing it, but creating it is different. And when with all due respect, and maybe you guys disagree, but when Donald Trump talks about fake news, what he is saying is that the reporters, the media, is providing fake news. That's not what this indictment's about. This is not the TASS. This is not alleging that TASS created phony news stories. This is people coming in and trying to literally create phony news to fool the American people. Well, and that's different. This is a fraud on the American people.
I think Trump would say... Maybe the media people didn't invent this fake news, but they did something worse. They took the fake news that was created by somebody else and trumpeted it as though it were something real. And that's the same kind of fake, or that's news that's as fake as news that the media simply made up.
No, it's different because one is intentional. If I'm a news reporter and I intentionally make up something I don't believe is true, that's one bad thing. But if I am fooled by an organization that is in fact secretly funded by the Russians, and they held a rally in New York City, and they get 500 people, and they have banners paid for by the Russians, and they have hats paid for by the Russians, and they have press releases paid for by the Russians, and they hire an actress to dress up like Hillary Clinton and sit in a cage,
but
that's
only
fake
if
news,
you're
but
fooled.
I don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Only if but you do know it.
How do I know the Russians paid for that?
Because you may not know the Russians that Russians paid for it, but you know that it's bogus. It's something that makes Trump look bad, and you're going to play that up against
it made Hillary look bad. But
no. One of the things that's to me about this, and I confess I haven't read. I flipped through the indictment. I realized there's an immense amount of detail, and I just didn't have time to read the whole thing. It's very interesting. As an amateur historian of the Cold War that I am, the continuity of Russian practices and the kind of things they do, creating front organizations, for example, creating front organizations and recruiting ordinary people who don't know that they're bogus
organizations.
They were
doing that in the 40s.
They were doing it in the it goes back to
and their president is the former head of the KGB.
Exactly. This is right out
I
of
should
the
be surprised.
This is right out of the KGB Swiss Army knife. This is standard Soviet style disruptive behavior against an opponent, and it's just remarkable to see that some things don't change.
But I wouldn't be blasé about it. It's like well,
no,
saying,
it's serious. No, you shouldn't be blasé. We shouldn't have been blasé during the Cold War.
And these exactly. And these are new methods. It's a little bit like the analogy might be that, you know, in the 50s, the Russians had certain kinds of missiles and certain kinds of planes that threatened mm-hmm. us. And so we tried to find out what they were.
Right.
Now they're using some very sophisticated cyber warfare.
Yes, right.
And it's good to know about it. And the American people need to know. I mean, maybe all of us sitting around this table, we know that if we read something on the internet, we don't know who really wrote that, you know, some TJ in Kansas. You know, we don't know who TJ is. But a lot of Americans, I don't think, do. And I think if this indictment does nothing else, if it tells them when you read something on the internet, whether it's pro-Trump or anti-Trump, don't take it at face value. You don't know who it is.
Well, another reality that you know we deal with here, and I've dealt with it for over 30 years, is we take telephone calls. We'll go to, you know, Fred in Tallahassee, Florida. Fred could be saying anything he wants. We solicit. We want the American people or my listeners to call in and react. But I have no way of knowing whether the people that are calling in offering testimony on issues are telling me the truth. I hope they are. I hope they understand, you know, at least the type of people we try to, you know, want to watch this program and listen to this program. But again, we don't know if there's trolls out there that are making stories up when they call in.
Plain speaking, Russian agents.
Could have been Russian.
You've
Some
taken
of them
those
could
calls.
Have been Russians.
You've taken sure. those calls, and I've heard you say, "Are you sure about that? Or who are you? Or what do you know? How do you know that?" I mean, you've sort of alerted your listeners that this may or may not be true.
Well, our calls, you know, we ask for everybody their first name, but they could be making that up.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying is that what we have here is, and I think you touched on it, is what makes this, I think, to me, scary is that. You have a foreign government that wants to – they want to create chaos,
mm-hmm.
okay? They want to create chaos. They want to make people in the United States think less of their country. And what I'm just saying is there are people that went out and knocked on doors for Donald Trump and knocked on doors for Bernie Sanders. And many of those people, because they have passions about what's wrong with America, they have every right to talk about that. And so you now have a foreign government that's using this, the legitimate frustration of the American people, which came through in this campaign. You have that, and it's being fanned. And it's being fanned by false IDs. I mean, there's the indictment deals with a conspiracy to, you know, for false identification. And they're using social media. And social media, I mean, we're going to get into social media when we talk about, you know, the Florida shooter as well. But social media accepting money for ads from, again, dummy organizations when the money's coming from Moscow, I mean, that's another thing that we're going to have to fight.
I got to tell you, I'm a little concerned about some of my fellow Americans who have become dependent on their news gathering through Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's where I get my news from. And I'm thinking,
mm-hmm.
am I some antediluvian sort of mm-hmm. anachronism in the world? You don't read, like, newspapers or magazines?
What You're about, people? Well, that's what about people who get their news from Jimmy Kimmel or Bill Maher?
But that's the world we live in. We know about it, and the Russians know about it.
Yeah,
well,
I think all your points are excellent. I want to suggest what I think is an even more scary proposition, and it may be the Russians' real endgame. It's not just disruption. What if it's not just disruption? What if they don't want to just cause chaos and see what happens and hope that anything that's bad for America is good for Russia? What if what they really want to do is make Americans know that your elections are phony? What if
right.
they want to destroy our faith in our democratic process?
Absolutely.
Because if Americans begin to believe that elections are phony here, then are we still a republic? Are we still a republic? If people start staying away because they say it doesn't matter, it's all fixed.
And it's an element of
the republic.
That's what the Clinton campaign has been trying to do since November 8th of 2016. That is, this is an illegitimate election. We can no longer properly elect people. And the Clinton campaign and the Democrats have been trying to do that, and it's working among a lot of people.
Well, I disagree with you.
Donald Trump during the campaign was the one that brought up voter fraud, that he wasn't sure whether there was going to be a fair election or not. And in one of the debates, both candidates were asked if they would accept the results. And Hillary said that she would accept the results. And Donald Trump said, well, it depends what the results are.
That's what happens. Exactly.
And he took a lot of you-know-what for saying that. But I guess the question that I would add, this gets back into the whether or not actually any votes were transferred. We don't, at least the indictments we know right now, we don't know that any specific examples that votes were changed.
That's not an allegation.
Well, right. No. Rosenstein said, and Rosenstein went further. He said there's no evidence that there
was.
You have to listen to the rest of Rosenstein's sentences. He said, in this indictment.
Yes.
In this indictment.
He was very specific about
that. No,
it's
very important. Yeah. In this indictment, no evidence of votes. But in this indictment, no evidence Americans knowingly participated.
When we come back, 1-800-723-8299. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Last Friday was when the indictments came down, but earlier in the week, the heads of all American intelligence were testifying before Congress, and Dan Coats, who's the head of director of National Intelligence, he was making the point, he was alerting those senators that the Russians were involved in plotting the 2018 and 2020 campaigns. So from a foundation of what we know now because of these indictments, the next step that I would like to at least get everybody to sort of weigh in on, and this gets back into the integrity of the ballot, the integrity of the way we vote in America, and I'm wondering where do we start, because it seems to me that there were attempts made, although it was not mentioned in these indictments, news stories indicated that there were attempts to tap in to the voting machinery and or leadership administration of elections in many states, including Illinois. So those attempts were made. There's been no evidence yet that any of those forays were successful, but it would seem to me that that would be the next logical place for an enemy to invade those areas for the simple purpose of creating this feeling amongst Americans that a vote doesn't matter because the vote is fraudulent in some way.
I would say that's a place to start, and the difficulty with it is you have 50 different voting systems since elections are the responsibility of the states.
Right.
And so even if the Congress said we need to have a standard, just passing a law like that is difficult. And two, getting the implementation in a timely way without providing the resources to make it happen, money, it'd go for naught, really.
I think actually having 50 systems just makes it more robust and harder for the Russians to crack it. I'd rather have 150 than one for them to attack. Another thing, though, is having electronic voting, touchscreen voting, versus a paper ballot that can be sheet machine fed. This is a situation where a retro process that's harder to hack, where you actually have a paper ballot, you put a mark in pen. You can machine read them. You can count them quickly, but it's easier to recount and it's harder to gimmick. And there's been numerous people pushing for a return to marked paper ballots to prevent this very thing.
I would be one that
actually
would
Cook County.
That.
I think I know that the where I vote in Skokie, it is it's a machine ballot. But before you finish voting,
there's a paper trail.
You take a look at the paper ballot that your voting has produced, and to me that's a great system. If there's ever a doubt about what happened in the precinct where I vote, people can go back in and check the electronic versus the. The trouble is, my guess is most people won't read that paper ballot when it's going through the machine. But
parties, Pat Cotter, in your view, do political parties want to send a signal that voting is on the up and up? Or is there just, depending on what jurisdictions the election is being held, do some political parties really don't care whether there's voter integrity or not?
Oh, no. I have to believe that the vast majority of all U.S. citizens, Republicans, Democrats, independents, want a system where the vote matters, where the vote has integrity. I can't imagine anybody thinking there was any advantage to having anybody anywhere think that it doesn't matter what you vote because it's all we've got a computer that can we can push a button and fix it. So
don't some people believe that voter suppression, however, does that?
Well, voter suppression, I think, is a separate issue. I mean, voter suppression is evil as well. I mean, I think the message of both parties, as far as I always remember, has always been get out and vote. You know, it's the classic last thing the politician says at the end of the debate. You know, whether you vote for me or not, make sure you vote. And that's American, and that's right. And I think that that makes sense. I just wanted to add to your other comments. I agree. We going back to an earlier technology may be the way to go. The other thing, though, is that as we educate ourselves as a society how to protect ourselves from other cyber threats, fraud, identity theft in just our everyday lives, the government has a role, people have a role, and I think we have to now apply that to the whole electoral process.
I think we have to also include that it's not just the voting technology, but it's the underlying database of legitimate voters. Because I'm thinking, if I want to disrupt something, I'll start tinkering with that database.
Yeah.
So that somebody shows up on election day and suddenly they're not on that list anymore, and now what happens? And you can look at I know at least in Cook County how often someone's voted, and I start hitting those super voters, people who I know are going to come out to the polls and driving that turnout down. That's about as disruptive as anything else as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're not going to protect the integrity of the databases that boards of elections maintain of registered voters, that's going to be a problem.
And by the way, the professional election mechanism of both parties is they want to use this new data. They mine the data. Mm-hmm. They want to send specific commercials or ads to specific people online.
Yep.
They want them to turn out. They want to do anything they can, maybe to discourage other people from turning out. So the way we run our elections in the United States, the Russians were aware of it, and the Russians were basically doing it in some cases, maybe better than the pros were.
It's right in the indictment, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
That's one of the overt acts, is that they had a whole department in Russia that was charged with analyzing the data, who was reading their ads,
right.
They were buying thousands of ads. Who's reading our ads? Where are we getting the best bang for our buck? So they're taking the same methodologies that our parties use, and they're using it actually to
a different
corrupt
end.
The whole
Absolutely.
Corrupt the whole election for everybody.
Question: we should mention, by the way, that we talked earlier that this included in this conspiracy that is mentioned here by the 13 Russians. There were rallies. There were political rallies on both sides, and the rallies did not end on Election Day. So there were rallies in New York for pro-Trump, and there were rallies in New York, not my president. You probably saw those placards all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be some people out there that were out there legitimately, and they believed that, and they were Americans. They were the unwitting Americans that are referenced throughout this indictment. But there were a lot of people out there who were planning this, and they were Russians. And so I would go back to something Marty alluded to, is not my president, the resist movement. And as Donald Trump, in fact, Fritz, if you want to put up the tweet that the president made, he made he's been tweeting like a crazy man lately, but he's one of his tweets in the last 48 hours is, if it was the goal of Russia to create discord, disruption, and chaos within the U.S., then with all of the committee hearings, investigations, and party hatred, they have succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. And he went on to say they'd be laughing their asses off in Moscow because of what we're discussing right here. Is there truth to that?
Unfortunately, yes, and there have to be investigations. So to sort of poo-poo that idea, yeah, we have to know the extent of this, and it has to be public.
Does the resist movement, resist, does the resist movement feed in to this conspiracy? Is this one of the products of this conspiracy?
No. That is silly. That to say that is to say that the Trump movement, that the pro-Trump people are feeding into the conspiracy. The Russians didn't invent resist, and the Russians didn't invent pro-Trump. What they did is they tried to misuse both movements to carry out their ends. It would be a horrible mistake to suggest that a honest political expression somehow is to blame for this. These are our criminals from overseas, our enemies, coming in and trying to disrupt our process.
No, but in the past, Patrick, there was an election. There were hard-fought elections. Somebody won, somebody lost. The person that won governed. The person that didn't, that lost, they would go out and they would lick their wounds and they would plan for the next campaign. That hasn't happened here.
I don't think that's true, Bruce. That's not the history. I mean, when Barack Obama won, it wasn't that everybody said, oh, okay, he's the president, let's just go forward. I mean, let's remember.
Undermined at every turn.
How did Donald Trump first come to power? How did he first come up?
Because he was a birther.
He said he was trying to get him impeached. He said he wasn't qualified to be president. Right. It was illegal for him to be president. The idea that in the past, everybody shook hands and we just went forward. That's just not true. That's ahistorical. Donald Trump is president today because he was a birther who said that Barack Obama was legally ineligible to be president of the United States and that he should be impeached.
You think that's why he was elected?
It's why he became prominent politically. That's how he first came on the scene.
Michael. Trump was famous for all kinds of things, and he was looking for an issue. If he wanted to run for president, he didn't need the birther thing. But I think it's more interesting, though, is his question.
But he used it.
Barack Obama had on his publication material for his book that he was born in Kenya and claimed he didn't know it. Okay, so he probably wanted to use his exotic name and that to promote himself. There were reasons why people were concerned about it. He published his birth certificate that put the end to it. I never particularly concerned myself.
Not for Mr. Trump. He continued to flog that
anyway,
for a year.
I don't want to – that's ancient history. What's more interesting going forward is this, is, again, the Soviet methods and now these Russian methods. I don't think that the resist movement is a wholly Russian invention.
Nor
certainly
do I.
Not. But it's very interesting to see, for example, one of the great examples was during the resistance to the missiles being put in Europe at the beginning of the Reagan administration. There were grassroots people in Britain, the United States, and Germany, but the KGB put in an enormous amount of effort, personnel, money, to make those resist that movement much bigger than it might otherwise have been. So the Russians are good at this sort of thing. We should try to be aware of it and try to go resist it. But I'd also point out
there was involvement also in certain elements of the civil rights movement.
Of course there was, because they were. But here's the thing: if you're the Soviets and you're the KGB, and the United States is your mortal enemy, you're looking to get people into every important organization and every movement and see what use you can make of it.
Including the Trump campaign, and that's what this indictment is
about. I wouldn't doubt they had people in both campaigns.
Right. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, we'll hear from Austin, Texas. Don't go away. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Phil Beverly, everything we've been talking about tonight, specifics of this 13 people, Russians, indicted in 37-page indictment, it all happened on Barack Obama's watch. James Comey was the head of the FBI.
Yes.
What is that? Does that, as a Democrat, does it bother you that the president did not have a better handle on this investigation while it was unfolding? Or did they?
I think he had as good a handle on it as he could possibly have. The Russians are good at what they do oftentimes. They had a major national-level doping scheme for their athletes that finally got uncovered. They've been doing this for decades. So to think that we can just disrupt it, I think it cuts across presidencies. I mean, if we were going to take a historical view, I'm sort of interested in now the 2000 election. That was a very close, polarizing, half-million vote separation election. And I'm not complaining about W getting elected as much as was their interference in the process now. Mm-hmm. Because the Russians, maybe they benefit somehow from that.
Pat Conner, you worked in the Justice Department for many, many years as an assistant United States attorney in Brooklyn, New York. This did happen on Obama's watch.
We got attacked, Bruce. We got attacked. It's like 9/11, Pearl Harbor.
We got attacked, but it's we're now a year and a half later, and we're now dealing with the specifics. How much of what is in this indictment known by the Justice Department or the FBI months or
first of all, we don't know. We don't know. But if you read the indictment, while it talks about 2014, a lot of lawyers out there are nodding their heads and they're saying, yeah, I know why you do that, because you always want to have a very early start date on your conspiracy so that you catch all the acts. So you always make it much earlier than it was. But if you read the indictment, the vast majority of the actions that are alleged here started in June 2016. So we're not talking about things that were going on for years and years. We're talking about things that happened during the election. And indeed, your comment earlier was exactly right, Bruce. Some of these activities continued after the election. They mm-hmm. continued to have rallies and things. So we're talking about things that really, if you think about it, if you know criminal indictments in the federal system, this is incredibly up to date. We usually don't get indictments about things that happened 6 months ago. That's a pretty new thing. I take your point, but I think it's a little misleading to suggest that if enemies of the country are doing things, that somehow that's the president's fault. This is stuff that happened very recently. It's been now brought to light in a very detailed way. I think it reflects well on our intelligence people that they've done this job. And I really don't think it would be fair to say that somehow Barack Obama should have imagined this. He should have looked in his crystal ball and known.
Maybe Barack Obama shouldn't have, but Clapper and Brennan, these were the guys who were in charge of the, and Comey especially, these were the guys who were in charge of defending us at the most basic level. Maybe they wouldn't go into Obama and say, we got this going on, but Clapper and Brennan and Comey, if they let it go on, that's different, and they are Obama's guys.
Well, I do remember they did bring it to the president before the election, and there was actually a news story this week about a memo that came out of a meeting where law enforcement came to the president and said, we have information that the Russians may be interfering with the election right now as we speak. And it was a very tricky situation, and the memo reflects that the president said, well, look, I want you to do everything you can. This is very important, but you got to do it by the book. That was his phrase. He said, you got to do it by the book, because he realized he couldn't run out to the American people and say the Russians are interfering with our election. He'd be accused of trying to throw the election
for Hillary.
All of these emails are dated June of 2016 and July of 2016. Why weren't they stopping those emails then?
Well, we didn't get them in real time.
I think they did.
We don't know. It's one of the things that's strange about this indictment is it's a kind of glimpse into the counterespionage world. And we get a glimpse of some of the things our people are capable of detecting and picking up on. We don't know what they didn't tell us. We don't know about the activities of 100 Russians they're just still spying on or feeding false information to or anything else. And my thing to trouble me the most about this is I don't like the idea that the means and methods we use to get this has been disclosed. That maybe why are we indicting people who are never going to be arrested, never in prison, and never really prosecuted? Maybe the proper response is a counterintelligence response, is to hack the Russians back in some way.
And why do you think we're not doing that?
I don't think we aren't. I think we probably are, and I think we probably shouldn't be hearing about it.
But let me point out, this would never have been released without the security apparatus, NSA, CIA approving it.
Absolutely.
So they clear this sort of thing. And indeed, I even in my little world back when I was a federal prosecutor, there were a few times where we had to clear something with national security about our methods. Your point is a very good one, I think. I think it's very valid. But I don't think anybody should take from this that somehow Mueller is not considering that.
And I'll also mention I'm gonna pat myself on the back a little that I didn't put on my partisan hat and go after Barack Obama, because we don't know what other things the Obama administration was doing. There's no reason to think this is a comprehensive picture of what our government knew about what the Russians.
Oh sure,
were doing.
No, this is an indictment. Right, this is not right. A report to Congress. This is an indictment. It's a different animal.
And going after the Russians is a little dicey because of they aren't technologically, as a culture, as sophisticated as we are here.
I'm not sure.
Allegedly.
Their intelligence services are probably as good as
ours. It's like what they say about the FBI, the world's greatest law enforcement agency, allegedly. We're going to talk about other things they've been involved in when we continue. Thanks for joining us tonight. In the next hour, we'll be switching gears. We will be taking the calls that are on the line, but we'll also be switching gears and talking about the tragic school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Don't go away.
This winter, Goodman Theater brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays, and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Back in Chicago, we continue with hour number two of our broadcast, and we're going to We're going to switch gears for a while. We'll take calls in just a moment, but I do want to switch gears and talk about the tragic shooting in Parkland, Florida. 17 young students shot dead by a Florida shooter. And one of the aspects of this, in the wake of these frequent school shootings, there are quick calls for gun control, and there are calls also for mental health to look into the perpetrator. I think in each of these cases, I think both of those are roads that should be traveled. I do not think we should dismiss gun control from this debate, and I do believe that the president should have at least referenced the word gun once or twice in his speech to the nation last week, although I thought his outreach directly to troubled young Americans was sort of unique for a president, and I thought he delivered in somewhat of an emotional way. However, in this particular case, we're talking about, I think, almost the bigger issue to discuss, at least at this moment, are all the telltale signs that were missed by law enforcement, and most importantly, missed by the FBI. There's a tip line. We've been taught as Americans since 9/11 to, if you see something, say something. Someone believed in that. They called the FBI tip line, and the tip that they gave to the FBI about the shooter and some of the things that he had said in the past, his actions as well as his fascination with guns, it fell through the cracks. And the other day in Florida, the head of the Florida FBI, the special agent in charge, Mr. Lasky, went before the cameras, and this was his response to what happened and why the FBI dropped the ball on this case.
Under normal protocol, this information should have been provided to the Miami field office. Their appropriate investigative steps would have been taken. The FBI has determined that protocol was not followed.
Marty Garrity, do you agree that the FBI situation maybe is the place to start so this does not happen again, or should we start with gun control or mental health?
Well, I think that the FBI situation is very pertinent here, and it's especially interesting that when somebody had to announce that the Washington, D.C., or the headquarters of the FBI had not followed protocol, they sent that down to Lasky down in Miami. They made him be the one who was telling that his organization failed the people of the United States. So to me, the very fact that Lasky was the guy who was asked to deliver this bombshell is an indicator that the FBI knows they really screwed up.
Bill Beverly, in your view, could this action have come at a worse time for the FBI?
Being under fire from the President of the United States for the last year and some months, it's bad timing. And I just got to say that the three agencies that weren't mentioned were the local police department, the county sheriff, and the Florida State Police. Why aren't they equally as culpable in investigating something that they should be more familiar with, since this is a really a local matter? The other thing
there was no tip line involved with them.
There was no indication that I heard how many tips come in on this tip line. How many people are they supposed to investigate that will probably be unfounded? I mean, this shooter had a mental health evaluation and was not forcibly hospitalized for it. So obviously there was no foundation to determine that beyond his words and Snapchats or Instagrams or whatever, those aren't a crime yet.
So could this have been prevented?
Well, Bruce,
Michael?
Based on what I know, I don't think we have enough information to assess the scale of failure on the part of the FBI. He said protocol wasn't followed. Like Phil just said, I don't know if they get 10,000 tips or five. I don't know whether they have a established process, if they have something like this, where they could have gone to see this guy and talked to him, and that would have been. I don't think we have enough information, other than the FBI has to some extent admitted they got something wrong. But I don't know how critical we can be. And as far as somehow thinking that some policy change is going to prevent future terrible crimes like this, we know that if we were to outlaw, rifles tomorrow, they'd go into hiding. They'd become a black market in them, like as a black market and all the other illegal things people want. There's not what I would say is, and I've thought this for a long time, we need to secure these schools more. And we need to respect the fact we live in a country with 100 million rifles.
Pat Cotter also joins us. Pat, you have been a defender of and critic of the FBI in your many visits on this program. When you look at what you know right now based on the public reporting, how badly did the FBI screw up?
Well, I want to say two things. I want to say we all wish that the FBI had somehow used the tip they got, whatever it was, and somehow reached this kid and found a way to prevent this. There's a lot of ifs in that wish, because we don't know. Even if they'd reached him, they couldn't arrest him because they got a tip. But let me just say this, I'm not trying to just sweep away the FBI thing. We have had dozens of school shootings. I don't believe that the real issue, with all due respect, that we should be focusing on as a nation right now is whether the FBI missed a tip on this one. We should be looking at what's more important, which is there anything we can do about school shootings? And with all due respect, and I do respect your position, I take a different view. I take the view that we have a lot of problems in this country that we address with policies. Drugs, illegal drugs, very dangerous. We address that with policies. It doesn't get all the drugs off the street. There's still illicit drugs. But I believe that it's better than simply saying, well, anybody can sell ecstasy and cocaine to anybody on the street they want and it can be legal. I think that there are reasonable policies that could be put in place that could start to have some effect on some of these shootings. Remember, this young man bought this gun legally.
Right.
He did not buy it underground. He bought it legally. And there is no reason any 19-year-old, mentally competent or otherwise, in my opinion, needs an AR-15 when he's living in Miami. I think that reasonable people can come up with reasonable policies that could make some progress. And there is no magic wand. There is no perfect policy. But I think we can do better than throwing up our hands and saying, this is the price of freedom, which is a comment I heard once after a school shooting, which I almost lost my lunch. I don't think the price of freedom is 17 dead kids. I think we're an intelligent country. We're a great country. We can all agree that this is evil, and I think we can come up with reasonable policies to help.
Is it reasonable, in your view, Marty, to say AR 15s are illegal?
Well, the last time I actually held a gun was when I was in the Army about 45 years ago or so. So I don't know, but what I hear is that you can say AR-15, but then there's the AR-14 or the AR-27 or the this or that. And so what's
automatic?
It's not automatic. It's a semi-automatic.
A semi-automatic weapon. Should that be banned?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. We have a Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is we could amend the Constitution. It's keep and bear arms, and bear arms means a man-portable weapon. You could put some restrictions on it, but we have a lot of restrictions on guns now.
You think that's what the founding fathers had?
Yeah, they meant military-type weapons in the hands of civilians as a check on tyranny. That's precisely what it meant.
A 19-year-old with mental problems?
We had mental problems. I don't know. Mental problems might be a basis to not let the kid legally buy it. But, yeah, 19-year-olds fought in all of our wars.
Let's come back. 1-800-723-8289.
This winter, Goodman Theater brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're going to take calls. Let's go to Roger, listening to us in Austin, Texas on KLBJ. Roger, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good evening, Bruce. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
On that gun thing, you know, you're playing a game of whack-a-mole. It could be a gun this time. Next time they rent a big truck and run through the schoolyard. You can't fix crazy. You can only try to mitigate it as best you can. But on this Russian indictment, you know, this thing took legs back in 2014 when I think it was Krylova and Bogachiva and those people came over and started setting this thing up. And much of it centers around, you know, Concord and Internet Research controlling this effort to craft opinion on the Internet and on social media. And, you know, they're just joining a train that was already rolling pretty hard. And, you know, I read a lot of political stuff, Rolling Stone, Hill, Politico, Huffington Post, the Daily Kos. Read those comments. Trump got trashed and slandered and libeled like unbelievable with just tons of false information. And this wasn't coming from the Russians. This was coming from American citizens who were complaining, oh, he's never paid any taxes. He's a tax avoider. He's been sued 2,000 times. And, you know, not taking into account that three-fourths of those suits he was the plaintiff in, and he prevailed in almost all of them.
So you're saying there was the negative information that was being disseminated about Donald Trump, which happens in all campaigns, you're just saying the Russians just decided to pile on?
No, I don't necessarily think the Russians were involved so much. I'm just saying that train was already rolling down the track, and it was running over Donald Trump. It just was amazing, some of the misinformation that I was reading. And I'd go on there and, you know.
But Roger, it, you know, you may be talking about the general election, but in the buildup prior to the nomination, all those things were out there, but Donald Trump kept winning elections. None of this stuff was affecting him at all. He was Teflon Don.
Yeah, much to the amazement of the press.
Everybody.
It seemed like every week the press on the Sunday shows, well, this is the thing that's going to do him in. And you know, he just kept going. But right. I think to try to criticize the Russians and their efforts as, you know, maybe being a game changer or something. They just, like you say, they just kind of piled on.
They rolled with the punches.
An existing phenomenon.
Roger, let me ask you a question here on the subject that we're talking about in this hour. From your perspective in Austin, Texas, which is a city that it was known for decades as the most significant mass murder in the United States took place in that tower back in 1966. But my question to you is, in this particular case, what would you do to try to reduce the number of school shootings? We're never going to eliminate them, but how do we go about reducing them, and where should we focus our attention and our dollars and everything else?
You know, you're right. You're never going to eliminate it. You know, reduction, I think, having more perhaps armed teachers or things that could countermeasure the assailants that are there, higher security into the schools as far as entry and access. These are things that probably are common sense. I hear a lot of people suggesting.
I want to get I want to get everybody's reaction to that. Phil Beverly, arming teachers, or I will expand it, having someone in the school who is armed, and having someone like that in every school in America. Does that help in any way at all?
I think that's a roll of the dice. I think you're going to be spending money that, especially in school districts that don't have sort of excess dollars to spend anyway, that may not be the best thing.
Does anybody think that's a good idea?
I think it's a terrific idea.
Yes.
Okay, we're hearing from our Republicans now, Marty.
You would say the federal government comes up with, I don't know, $100 million or some sum that says to every school in America, if you can put five teachers who volunteer to learn to use these weapons and give them a lockbox where this weapon stays in the classroom and can only be opened by their own, I don't know, facial recognition or their thumbprint, like my iPhone, and you give them $10,000 extra a year. Personally, I think a lot of teachers love their children so much that they would do it without the $10,000. But give them $10,000 extra for being these protectors.
We could work out the exact mechanics. But what we do now is we say this is a gun-free zone, and we tell the world that this is a defenseless place. If we had a warehouse full of valuable products, we'd have a double lock to be let in. You need to show, you know, you couldn't walk in with a rifle. We should start treating the schools and the people in them as having that type of value. And if there are school districts, and there certainly are, that are strapped for funds, we should make sure that they have the state-of-the-art defense as well.
Patrick Cotter.
Yeah,
from the
are we going to have guards on the Las Vegas Strip at a country music concert? Are we going to have guards at a disco in Florida?
My point is,
I don't think when you look around the world, there's not another country on earth that has this problem.
Well,
and I
that's
don't
not
think
exactly
if
right.
I may finish, if I may finish, if I may finish, the idea that the answer is to put guns in the hands of teachers so that maybe they can shoot it out with some guy who comes in with an AR-15 and that they're going to win and that somehow this is going to protect our children, I just think that's fantasy. And it's ignoring the real problem. The real problem is not that we don't have teachers who are fast enough on the draw. The real problem is that we have a system that allows legally sick people to buy weapons that are more that were built to be used by soldiers in combat, and that they can legally take them anywhere they want. They can buy ammunition and they can use them anywhere, in a school, in a mall, at a concert. That's the problem. You want to talk about whack-a-mole? I think the caller used that phrase. Okay, so we're going to like load up the schools with armed teachers. They're just going to go somewhere else. That's not the point. The point is, we've got to do something systemic. We've got to address the real problem, and the real problem is not that our teachers aren't fast enough on the draw.
Mass killers go to places they know they won't encounter a gun. We know that. They'll drive around and go to a movie theater that has a gun-free zone sign. The disco in Florida had a gun-free zone sign, even though it's a concealed carry state. These people, we talked about this, I don't know if it was on the break or earlier, even people who are fairly mentally defective can still respond to incentives. The schools are inadequately secured for what they are, and the environment is going to change more slowly than you can change the security in these schools.
But you know, the White House is not secure enough when you've got people running across the lawn about to penetrate the building. So
determined attackers can
get
through.
Exactly. Determined attackers can get through.
But determined attackers can get guns.
Last word to you, and then we're going to move on.
Sure. Thank you. Welcome to the 21st century. We're not going to fix these problems. They're going to continue because you can't fix crazy.
Thanks very much. We're going to go to Terry in Fort Wayne, Indiana, listening on Go ahead. You're on the air, Terry.
Yes. I just want to say I see a lot of people in the media are asking, you know, why hasn't Trump done something to Russia? We've got to do something to Russia. And I still have some Russian colleagues. Hello?
Yes.
I still have some Russian colleagues from when I taught in Korea that I keep in touch with, and they're kind of like, well, what do you expect? You put sanction after sanction on us? They truly believe that we were involved in the Ukraine? And they're like, what do you think we're going to do, just shake in our boots and go hide because, oh, America's mad at us? You know, and I'm not really sure. I feel the press hates Trump so much they've been willing to destroy any chance to work with Russia in a positive way, and that we're going to take a step too far. I think President Obama didn't do anything.
Terry, let me ask you, based on this indictment, should there be some retaliation, sanction, penalty against the Russian government? Yes or no?
I'm just shocked that they were involved in our elections, that another country would interfere with another election. I'm sure they should be, but I don't think it's going to do any good. I'm worried we're going to
But again, should we do anything? Do they get their hands slapped? Do they get punched in the mouth? What happens?
I think we should try to sit down and talk with them and work out our differences. I think as a political reality,
Marty's shaking his head. Our Republican is shaking your head with the idea.
You can't sit down and talk to the Russians about whether they should be nice to us during our elections. I mean, your example of Ukraine is ludicrous. We step back from the Ukraine or from helping the Ukrainians. We let the Russians take Crimea. We didn't give the Ukrainians even handguns to fight off the bad guys until Trump came along, and now Trump is saying we're going to give you some weapons. But
well,
this is
they would say we've been interfering with, you know, again, I don't.
But they would lie if they were saying that, Terry. Well, we haven't been interfering with the Ukraine.
We've been involved with interfering with their elections, have we not?
Sure, we have.
Around the world?
I don't know.
The USA has been involved.
You don't think the United States has ever been
involved? Does it matter who gets elected in Russia? I mean, do we bother with their elections in Russia?
Well,
no, I don't.
Hillary Clinton was involved in that, which is one of the reasons why Putin hates Hillary Clinton.
Except that
he bought his uranium from her, so that's nice.
Vladimir Putin was out to sink Hillary Clinton's campaign. That is part of the motivation that we're dealing with tonight. Because you said the leader was a KGB agent. He did not like what Hillary Clinton did to him personally. And he was out to get her. And he got her. Back shortly from Chicago. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Bruce Dumont back. In the state of Florida, there's a thing called the Baker Act. The Baker Act allows for the involuntary examination of someone who can be committed based on the actions of a judge, law enforcement officials, physicians, or mental health professionals. And there must be evidence that that mental illness is indeed a possibility in this individual, and that there is a danger of becoming doing harm to self or harm to others or self-inflicted. So this is a law in the state of Florida. It's called the Baker Act. And no one in law enforcement used this act to detain, involuntarily detain, the shooter in Florida. So this is, you know, one piece of law that's out there. Another piece of law that perhaps will get a lot of attention in the weeks to come, and that is a law called the restraining order for guns. It could curb some mass shootings. And this, according to ABC News, it's called Extreme Risk Protection Order. It's a law in which gives family members and police authorities the power to restrict a person from getting a gun if that person displays behavior which can cause danger with the possession of a firearm. This is now the law in four states: Washington, that was the most recent state, California, Connecticut, and Oregon. And so this is an existing law in those states. And there are literally about 35 pieces of legislation in 35 states moving forward to varying degree at this very moment, that this law will be moving through your state legislature if you're not in this state. But does this idea sound like a good idea to everybody, that this is maybe a first step legislatively, that if someone is acting in a potentially dangerous way and maybe has access to weapons, either members of their family or law enforcement or the mental health facility can put this guy on a list and prohibit him from getting a gun.
As you've sketched it out, it sounds like it may work. It's a question of how it's implemented. Of course, what you can immediately imagine a scenario where it was abused. You can also imagine a scenario where it's on the books and no one ever does it. But if again, what would be the standard? What would type of evidence would you have to have? Maybe, if, you know, I think the fact that they focus on family members, that's particularly helpful. The guy in Connecticut, his mother apparently was at her wit's end because he was clearly crazy and she didn't know what to do. If she had something like this, that may be a good way to do it. This is the kind of thing that would have to be implemented and tried, and we have to look at it over a period of years to see how well it's working.
But
what do you think of this idea, Phil?
How do you know how well it's working if you interrupt the potential act? You won't know that you necessarily
you won't know if you're
stopped,
successful.
Let me
right?
say it this way.
And then the other thing is, it's got to be time limited. I mean, you can't just interrupt somebody's constitutional right indefinitely without some standard of evidence. Now, I'm not a lawyer.
No. I think you're exactly right. Again, the sketch Bruce laid out, it sounds like it has some potential, but I don't know. We'd have to see. Look, I'd have to actually.
Well, let me add one more thing. This is a law which aims to restrict persons with mental health problems and violent behavior from accessing firearms where they might get more traction in light of the recent cases. This is legislation that's already passed in four states.
And so
so I'm saying it is. The president said the other day that, you know, we want to do something or whatever it is he wants to do. This seems to be a practical way. Now, this is at the statewide level. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is not going to be federal legislation. But again, here's four states. This seems to me to be a common sense first step in trying to resolve this issue. Pat?
I think it is a good step. I think, though, that it may be symbolic and useful in another way. I've often thought that one of the problems in this debate about gun control is that people tend to think of whatever anybody proposes, they say, well, nationwide, that wouldn't work. I accept that if you live out in a rural area and the nearest police officer is 30 minutes away, your argument for having a gun is different than perhaps my argument living in Chicago where – with 911, all things being equal, the police are there in a couple minutes. I think what this suggests is that part of the answer going forward is that there are policies that can help. But perhaps what it has to be is each individual state, and we have to allow communities to make rules that make sense for them. The same rule that would make a lot of sense in Chicago might not make any sense in rural Montana. It doesn't mean that it's a bad rule. It just means that it's a bad rule for Montana. It may be a very good, reasonable rule in Chicago. So I like this idea, but I think what we should take from it is not just this particular idea, but the idea that there are things we can do. Our last caller made a statement, and I get it, and I'm not beating up on him, but he said, welcome to the 21st century. This is the way it is. It's not the way it has to be. We're an intelligent civilization. Civilization has always been about trying to find ways to live better and more peacefully. That's the history of civilization, more and more peaceful societies. And I think that the idea that you just have to throw up your hands and say, you know what, now we have AR-15s, and every once in a while people are going to be massacred. I don't believe in that, and I don't accept it.
Michael.
I mean, the history of civilization is also that defenseless populations invite attack. And the southern whites made sure the blacks had no guns. And the British in India made sure the Indians had no guns so they could oppress them. And the Soviets made sure that people had no guns so they could kill them. And the Germans made sure the Jews had no guns so they should kill them. So they could. An armed population is a check on tyranny, and people laugh this off. The founders didn't laugh it off. They took it seriously. Now then, again, but the idea that we'd have a process to identify people who are mentally incapable of exercising the civil right to own firearms and have us – that may be the type of approach to take.
The person that is most likely to be able to identify whether or not an individual is, because of their behavior – is prone to antisocial activities, it is either a parent or it is a teacher. I think those are the two logical places, or it could be a minister, it could also be a minister, that there's disturbed people out there. And I feel for, and I've said this many times on this program, I feel for the parents out there who have children who they know are ticking time bombs. And either if they're very, very wealthy, they can take them to a very high-priced psychiatrist and try to work it out. if they were at the very low rung of the ladder, hopefully there are enough mental health facilities where they could go for assistance for themselves to stop something like this before it happens. I think the United States government is not spending enough money on mental health. I don't think states are spending enough money on mental health treatment. But then there's the big broad center. And the broad center are our parents who they're not wealthy, they're not poor, they're middle class. And they may be a mother, they may be a father, and they have a son or a daughter who they know could have been the Florida shooter. Because loneliness, depression, you name the mental illness that is dealt with, and they see it every day, and they're crying out. They have no place to go. In this particular case, we had someone who was a friend of this shooter who called an FBI tip line trying to do it. He wasn't even a relative. He was a friend. Friends could also do this. But the frustration of that of those parents who are trapped in a situation when they know their kid someday is going to do something horrible, either to themselves, to members of the family, or end up walking down to the local high school and killing 15, 20 people. I will bet tonight we have hundreds of individuals listening to this program who are in that same boat, scared out of their mind that their child could be the next shooter that ends up on international television. And there's not enough support for it. And one thing that the president said the other day, which, again, in the speech, again, where he did not mention guns, that was the big point, he didn't mention guns. But he spoke to the individual young Americans, and telling them there is a place where you can go. There's somebody, we can help you. We want to help you. But again, he's got to follow through on that. If he really says and believes that there should be a place for a young person whose life is lost or spiraling down, he's got to provide some funding so that mental health intervention is something that it's available. It first and foremost should be available at every school in America. I don't think you need another apparatus set up to deal with it. But we do not take mental health seriously in this country. We never have. And until we take mental health seriously, I think the other efforts, whether it's making schools safer or arming teachers or even outlawing AK-47s, which I think we should do anyway, or 15s rather, mental health is the core issue. It is the core issue. And I don't think this Congress, I don't think this nation, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, have ever seriously taken the issue of mental health and held it up for a public discussion. This is where the public discussion should be, because there are people out there, they are crying for help. Some of those are potential perpetrators, but most of them are parents, and they're pulling their hair out. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont, back. Pat Cotter, you were going to make a point.
Well, I was just saying that, you know, I think your point is well taken, Bruce. I think that even when the criminal justice system does have interaction with people who are mentally ill, who people in the system, the police, the judges, the prosecutors, even the defense attorneys, we see that the person is deeply troubled, and they scare us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The problem is that the criminal justice system simply is not set up to deal with that issue. We were not set up to deal with mental health. And there are so few places that you can send these folks, even the ones who are willing to go. And a lot of them won't go. And until they break the law, the criminal justice system has really got its hands cuffed. So I think the answer is certainly a huge part of it is providing mental health resources. I also think, though, as the point was made earlier, that I think there are these kinds of laws which could give law enforcement the ability to go and maybe investigate these things a little more robustly, maybe do a search. And if they do have guns, if they do have explosives, if we do find out more, we could do more. But there's no one answer. We've got to have mental health, but we've also got to give law enforcement the ability to do this. And as you said, we've got to have the people who know these people tell us, because law enforcement can't knock on every door in town and ask, is there anybody here you're worried about?
And I guess one of my worries is to sort of view this as a chess game. So we make a move, we institute a policy like this, and so what is someone who's committed to doing harm to other people going to do? Knowing that somebody could turn them in, are they going to now not keep firearms at their residence, mm-hmm. or are they going to cache them away somewhere else to access them later? I mean, we have to sort of play this five moves ahead.
Vince, by the way, I want to bring to Vince in El Paso, listening to us on KTSM. He's got a good question, and it's something we should kick around. Go ahead, Vince.
Yeah, I'd like to know who's going to decide who's mentally ill. A lot of Americans, you know, would probably throw Trump into that category. You're not going to be able to give him a gun. You're going to throw him in a padded cell. Who's going to decide?
I think, Vince, this is obviously a very touchy a question that you ask. It has to be some medical credentialed doctor. Mm-hmm. It can't be someone that's a political hire. It has to be someone who takes on the understanding, like any doctor does, to do no harm. But they have to make a judgment. My question to you is, who would you like it to be? I mean, I think the only thing that a parent can do, I'm thinking about the parents now, the only thing that the parent can do is the parent can, if they see something, they say something. Okay? The parent sees something. I want a mechanism where they can say something, and a professional, not themselves, not their brother-in-law, not even a police officer. I want a medical professional to come out and work with that parent to determine whether or not their son or their daughter is antisocial and will be violent in some way.
There's a number of psychiatrists that were on the media saying that Donald Trump was incompetent.
Right.
Okay. And those are professionals.
Well, I don't think they were accusing Donald of getting an AR-15 and taking out of school.
But he's pointing up an important point. And the important point is, you know, you're talking about combining state power and the government depriving people of their rights with a necessarily somewhat subjective medical opinion on something that's hard to determine. It's not like I can find a smallpox in a slide under a microscope and make a clear, you know, a diagnosis. So, but what I think is important, Bruce, the statute you talked about, as I understood what you read, we wouldn't have to make the mental health determination. We just need to have a level of concern that, say, a court could find satisfied the statute, permitting the police to conduct some level of investigation. Then if you find things like diaries and Facebook comments about threats, and you find weapons, you find explosives, then you may have a basis for an arrest. Then you may have a basis to confiscate things that could be dangerous.
But my whole – you're absolutely right. But my whole point is, what happens then?
Well, agreed.
What happens then? You've got to have something that you can do that will address the real problem, which is the mental illness. And let me just point out to the caller, there are people – and judges every day in this country who make exactly that determination. People are committed all the time. It's not it shouldn't be easy to do. It's not. It shouldn't be common. It's not. But it does happen. It's happened in this country for over 100 years, and it's not some freakish new idea. What we're talking about is using that process, adapting it to this new problem we have, and trying to both find a way to protect the public, but also address the problem and help these people. This is an illness. This is not evil. This is illness.
Vince, I would also say that in opposing this idea, if you're going to take it to the extreme and assume that there's no one that can make an intelligent, objective decision, then you're using that as, I think, you're using it as a roadblock. Because in that particular case, you know, no matter what legislation you come up with, somebody will come up with, well, yeah, but what about this or what about that? Those are legitimate reservations. But again, it should not stand in the way of trying to do something that will, for the most part, reduce it's not going to eliminate it, but reduce the situation. And maybe it's a special court with three doctors. I don't know. Maybe it's a panel of people that decide it. But we got to. But the point is, there needs to be a place where a parent who knows their kid's going to explode. There needs to be a place where they can go and get help. And in my view, that is the responsibility of government. That is the responsibility of government to protect the people against good people from bad people. On that note, I've got to say farewell. Our thanks to our guests. Thank you very much. Our thanks to Sam Greenberg, Dan Dorpin, and Fritz Goldman for their assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
This winter, Goodman Theater brings the historic meetings of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to the stage in Blind Date. It's 1985. As the Cold War looms, the world's most enigmatic leaders come together to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on chemistry. Blind Date is a slyly comic look at the encounter that changed history forever. Blind Date by Rogelio Martinez, directed by Tony Award winner Robert Falls. January 20th through February 25th. Get tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at briansellsthedesert.com.